Love Center Church, very happy to be with you again for another week as we continue in our series on the parables of Jesus. And this series will take us through the end of the year, at minimum the end of the year. We are in part two of what we've now determined will be a three-part series on the parable of the corrupt judge. Or as Amy Jo Levine puts it, the vengeful widow and the co-opted judge. So this parable does have a partner piece, which is the parable of the contemptible friend in Luke chapter 11. And so we'll be looking at those two together for this second layer of analysis today. So last week, just to review, we looked at this parable through a sociological and anthropological lens. And this week, we're going to examine the parable as a commentary on authentic faith and prayer. So this week, we're really looking at it through the lens of what it says about faith and prayer. And not only does the parable offer much on these topics, the topics of faith and prayer, but these are broad and rich topics anyway. So the analysis that I'll offer, I'll try to remain disciplined and remain focused on the parable and then some direct implications of it, so that we don't wander too far into either of these big ideas. My hope would be that as a community, and this is kind of it's an ongoing principle, I suppose, in our readings of the parables, is that the parables are meant to provoke. They are meant to leave us uneasy, leave us challenged, and to throw us in a way to take us off balance. And I think that we'll see that these two parables achieve this. They achieved it last week for me anyway, and as they serve as a commentary on authentic faith and prayer, I think they'll achieve it again. So that's where we'll begin. Last week, again, we looked at, just to kind of remind us of where we left off, last week in that first layer of meaning, we looked at the importance of prioritizing the individual over his or her affiliations, and we also talked about the importance of understanding the resistance against systemic oppression and how this resistance requires a commitment to justice over vengeance. So let's take a look now at Luke chapter 18. We'll actually start with Luke chapter 11 and look at the parable of the contemptible friend, and then we'll move to Luke 18, which is, again, really the corrupt judge remains the centerpiece, but we'll add this partner parable today. So here we are at Luke chapter 11. And it happened that as he was praying, when he finished, a certain one of his disciples said to him, "Lord, teach us to pray, just as John 2 taught his disciples." And he said to them, "When you pray, say, 'Father, let your name be held sacred. Let your kingdom come. Give us each day our bread for the day ahead, and forgive us our sins, for we also forgive all who are indebted to us. And do not bring us to trial." And he said to them, "Among you, what man would have a friend, and would come to him at midnight and say to him, 'Friend, lend me 3 loaves of bread, since a friend of mine has just visited me from the road, and I have nothing I might set before him?' And the one inside would say in response, 'Do not present me with difficulties. The door has already been closed, and my children and I are in bed. I cannot get up and give you anything. I tell you, even if he will not rise and give it to him because he is a friend, his friend, still on account of his persistence, he will rise and give him whatever he needs. And I tell you, ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find, knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone asking receives, and the one seeking finds, and to the one knocking it will be opened. And what father among you, if his son will ask for a fish, will hand him a snake instead of a fish? Or again, if he will ask for an egg, will instead hand him a scorpion? If therefore you, being wicked, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will the Father from heaven give a Holy Spirit to those asking him? So here we see the Jewish principle of the light and the weighty, which is a through line in both of these parables, the parable of the contemptible friend and the parable of the corrupt judge. And the through line, the principle of the light and the weighty is essentially that if this is how unjust players act, which is the light, how much more should be expected of the fully good God, which is the weighty. So there is this principle, of this interpretive principle, that certainly would have been familiar to Jewish listenership, and is structurally is present in both of these parables. Well, the through line is incredibly useful, and it will help guide us as we elaborate on the parable of the contemptible friend and the parable of the corrupt judge. So here is, again, the parable of the corrupt judge. And he told them a parable on the necessity of their always praying and not becoming remiss, saying, in a certain city there was a certain judge who did not fear God and who had no concern for humankind. And there was a widow in that city, and she came to him, saying, grant me justice over against my adversary. And for some time he would not, but thereafter he said within himself, though indeed I do not fear God, nor do I have any concern for humankind, I shall grant her justice simply because she bothers me, for fear that at the last she will entirely exhaust me with her visits. So, for today's discussion, we're looking at a commentary, the commentary this parable provides on authentic faith and prayer. And so I have four observations that will be used to walk us through my thinking around this parable. And in this case, the text that I relied on most frequently was certainly Young's parables, Jewish tradition and Christian interpretation. So those of you who do take notes or kind of sketch the outline as we think through the implications of this parable, there are four observations to take note of. The first one is this: prayer is inevitable and universal, but must not be viewed homogeneously. Prayer is inevitable and universal, but must not be viewed homogeneously. And I think this is, for the most part, something that has been settled by researchers who analyze the role of religion sociologically. I think that it's, for the most part, agreed upon that while prayer differs wildly from one religion to another, one culture to another, across time and geography, prayer can look very, very different. And we'll elaborate on the uniqueness of Christian prayer, but first, to understand that prayer is inevitable, it is something that is universal. It is a feature of, and perhaps, and interestingly, it seems to be a unique feature of what it is to be human. We not only have language, but we pray. And it's something that if you don't identify as a theist, it's something that at certain points in your life you would almost have to resist. It's very human to pray. It's a very natural thing in times of suffering and in times of distress. It's a very natural thing to cry out. Sometimes these are on an emotional register. Sometimes these run you know, very high, but at other times not. It seems to be a part of our nature to look out into the universe and to call out to something beyond ourselves. I think an essential component of understanding some of the insights, this is just really laying the groundwork, some of the insights this parable has to offer concerning concerning prayer and faith, is that prayer is at once inevitable and it is universal. So whatever you say about the efficacy of prayer, or whatever you think about good ways to pray, or prayers that strike you as unproductive, inappropriate, wrongheaded, there's a lot of evaluation that happens as it pertains to prayer, which I find very interesting. It's another signal that it's something that's valuable to us. But whatever you think about it, it is important to remember at once it is something that is universal. However, while universal, I don't think that we should presume. On the one hand, we know that prayer, while universal and inevitable, on the one hand, while we know that it varies radically from culture and place, from culture and place and time, from one to the other. On the other hand, we also know that we also should not think of prayer homogeneously as it pertains to the way we experience prayer or even its efficacy. So I first want to begin with this challenge or this question, which I think should be explored in your communities, and I'm sure you've already thought about many times, but it's worth asking the question, is all prayer equally effective? We know that it's not. We know that the ritual of prayer is not the same. Within a community, it's not the same. Within one's individual practices over one's life, it's not the same. But is all prayer equally effective? And if you determine that it is not, how might you begin to understand why not? So let's begin to think through some of this. As I said, this is a feature of what it is to be human. And because it is such a fundamental part of what it is to be human, we should be very interested, quickly interested. If you've not been, it's worth the work to become interested in how we think about prayer, how we experience prayer, and to anticipate a little bit of our discussion next week, the object of prayer, or the focus of prayer. This is part of our lived experience. So let's take a look at Matthew 4:4. Here, and we'll actually rewind and begin with verse 1. Then Jesus was led up into the wilderness by the Spirit to be tried by the slanderer, and having fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. And drawing near, the tempter said to him, "If you are God's son, command that these stones become loaves of bread." He, however, answered by saying, "It has been written, the human being shall live not upon bread alone, but upon every utterance issuing from the mouth of God." At once, Jesus places in a hierarchy of value not only the teachings of the Torah, the writings and the prophets, but also communication and the connection between himself and God the Father. He places this relationship, this connection, on the same level as food and water. And there's something that resonates between Matthew chapter 4 and what we see in the parable of the widow and the corrupt judge. There is anger, as we discussed last week. One valid reading, and I think it has merit. One valid reading is there's much to critique about the widow. And there are many stereotypes we build around the widow. However, the widow is not attempting to conceal or to hide her need. In no way is she attempting to distance herself from her vengefulness. And in that way, in no way is she attempting to distance herself from her humanness. She is, in the parable as it's presented, she is very human. She is quite desperate. This gets to another kind of way this is also in a way another critique of the ways we think about certain emotions within religion. I mean, you can be desperate and also incredibly angry. At once you can be desperate, and in that desperation, you can be saying something or doing something sincere, but still be wrongheaded. The widow may have motives that are less than noble, less than virtuous, but still she is presenting herself fully before the judge. And I think that there's something to take away here on the universality of prayer, the inevitability of prayer, but also the honesty that we should bring in prayer. Here's a quote from Anne Lamott on prayer and the presence of God. "If I were going to begin practicing the presence of God for the first time today, it would help to begin by admitting the three most terrible truths of our existence: that we are so ruined and so loved and in charge of so little." When I think of the parable of the widow, I'm intrigued by analysis that challenges her virtuousness or her meekness or her innocence, but I'm even more interested in the ways in which her behavior is a commentary on prayer. And it seems to me that at once prayer recognizes that we are ruined, which is to say that alone we are finished. We are unmoored. And it holds that so closely with this other principle or truth, which is that we're also loved, and finally a recognition that almost everything is outside of our control. There's something about this that places us in a position of desperation, where prayer becomes as needed, as valued as bread and water. And I think that is a part of the story that Jesus gives us. We are building a kingdom in the midst of another kingdom that is crumbling, in the midst of a world that is falling apart. And we can't experience the love of Christ in prayer without also recognizing our lack of control, without also coming from a place of sincere need, knowing that without Christ's intervention, without his imminence, we are in fact so ruined. So all of these seem to insist upon being held together as we think about what it is to engage in the act of prayer. Well, this leads us to the second observation today. So that number one, prayer is inevitable and universal, but must not be viewed homogeneously. Number two, faith and prayer must be understood as two parts of the same whole. Ian Bounds, who has been a tremendous value to me as I've thought about prayer over the years, says this: when faith ceases to pray, it ceases to live. I believe that acts of faith and acts of prayer are so closely linked, so intimately connected, they are almost two forms of the same thing. I'm aware that I do think we should distinguish them, but they always exist within the same breath. When you think about your experience of faith, is it not also an act of prayer? So to ask that again, and it may be that I'm wrong about this, and it's worth discussing in community, but when you think about your experience of faith, is your faith not at once always an act of prayer? I don't really know how to experience faith. And as I've thought about what, as you begin to try to map what it even means to experience faith, or assign language to that, I've been working on reading quite a lot about faith and thinking a lot about it over the last, I don't know, maybe 6 months or so. And no doubt, as a community, we'll address it very thoroughly sometime in the future. But as I've been thinking about faith, I don't really understand it without at once talking about prayer. I mean, we can think about what it might be, and I wouldn't classify that as prayer, per se. But when you're engaging in, when you feel that you are living in faith, experiencing your faith, and engaging in it, however you begin to kind of qualify the experience of faith, is it not also that you're at once talking about prayer? Is it not also an act of communication or an act of recognition of the presence of the divine? So there are some objections to this closeness between faith and prayer, and I want to consider those because I think that if we begin to see how much these two experiences of God overlap, I think we'll be better off as followers of Christ. So let's deal with some objections so that we can think through it as clearly as possible. I mean, one possible objection would be something like this. Well, someone might say, when I think about my lack of faith, for example, or my doubt, certainly this should not be constituted as prayer. But I don't know that, depending on how far you take the parable, I don't know that the parable of the corrupt judge allows for that kind of interpretation, the idea that doubt must not be a function of prayer. If you are experiencing doubt within your faith life, within your faith experience, in fact, doubt is an arrow not pointing you away from God, but doubt is just another mechanism by which you experience your faith more. And you're still persisting, in other words. You're still the widow. Nagging, insisting, you know, you're still the friend banging on the door. Doubt, when we think about the role of doubt, one way to think about it is that it is moving us further from God. And I think there's room to have that conversation, but another way to think about doubt is that as we are experiencing doubt within the process of focusing on God and engaging in the object of our ultimate concern, right? As we're experiencing doubt in that process, we're actually refining our faith. I suppose that's how I experience or think about doubt in my own faith walk. It's not as if every doubt is this problem to be solved, but when faith endures doubt, does it not further solidify your experience of Christ and the presence of God when faith endures doubt? When it endures it, what I mean by that is to say that maybe there are these doubts, these open questions that are still lingering. When faith persists through that, doesn't it deepen the relationship? Or when faith overcomes it, doesn't it deepen the relationship? So that's one possible objection that I don't think necessarily holds. Another possible objection is something like this. Well, what about when I find myself having faith in something other than God? You might argue that this is something like when doubt comes to fruition, or when your faith is the object of your ultimate concern is something other than the fullness of Christ. Isn't this an example of faith without prayer? And maybe that's so. But I'm more inclined to think the faith you express in an object which proves to be false only furthers your understanding and experience of what isn't false. And I frankly also see this as a form of persistence. You can imagine, I mean, there are many scenarios, and we really don't need to, it's obvious, so they need not be elaborated. But I mean, I don't know, you can imagine somebody who really puts all of their faith in their financial security. I mean, this is a fundamental feature of the American experience. It's either what you're doing or it's your goal to be in that place where you can do something like that, where your faith really is in your financial portfolio. And when the bottom drops out on that, and that can happen in a number of ways. I mean, it can happen through like some external variable where there's a recession or something like that. But it can also happen when you look at your financial status and you see that you have all that you could possibly want. You have all of the security you thought that that wealth would promise you, that wealth would provide you, and it's still not satisfactory. Yes, that realization, those insights, those moments of clarity, the deficiency of faith placed in an idol, strike me as a feature, a way by which God brings us closer to Him, or catalyzes us to step into His family, to see ourselves eventually as sons and daughters. So even that can become a type of persistence. So, well, what do we mean by the persistence of the widow or of the friend anyway, which is an important word that we've not yet really delved into in these parables? The translation of the word doesn't require much elaboration. I think that most of the translations I've looked at really do sum it up well. So this is not something where the translation necessarily unpacks much new meaning. However, I do think that some translations are better than others. It literally renders that there's a shamelessness in her pursuit of vengeance, in her pursuit of a ruling from the judge. But this same word could also mean something like, and I think arguably maybe even a better word, is something like tenacity or bold tenacity. Young talks about this. He says the Hebrew equivalent is important here. This is where we arrive at maybe the first time we really encounter this word in the New Testament, which is something like chutzpah. This she has some nerve, this raw, brazen perseverance. And I think that when we think about the relationship between faith and prayer, we should be challenged by this. Is this how Jesus would have us understand faith? Is this how Jesus would have us understand prayer? And I think that we need to explore that as a community. So my third observation today, which is really at the centerpiece of the entire message and this analysis, will receive the most attention. It's this. Observation number three. Don't reject persistence in prayer because you have adopted its caricature as the authentic article. And I know there's a lot happening in that sentence, but don't reject persistence in prayer because you have adopted its caricature as the authentic article. And I think there's some really important insights that this parable provides that I think speaks to. It certainly spoke to me, but I also think it speaks to members of our community as well. So for example, generally speaking, what are your thoughts of this sort of individual? If I were to sketch out somebody like this for you, this is the person who, in prayer, works themselves into a frenzy. This is a person who cries or who yells or who expresses prayer as almost a sort of theater, because this person expects these acts to garner favor or to generate attention from God. So first, let's deal with the obvious. There are passages in the New Testament. We are encouraged. I think it's quite clear throughout the scriptures. We are encouraged to recognize our desperation and to recognize our need in prayer. But also, we are encouraged in our prayers to engage God from a place of humility, and we're certainly discouraged from abusing prayer and treating it as a mechanism by which we gain attention or notoriety or credibility or whatever. I mean, that's present in the scriptures, and we could delve into that and have discussion around it. I'm not arguing that it isn't, but we need to ask, I think, some better questions of this type of person, because I think the widow challenges some of the caricatures we built around persistence in prayer. So if you hear about a person like this, and some of you, I'm sure, have known people that are like this, you feel that you're almost watching some kind of a performance playing out in front of you. I'm sure you're as critical as I have been, or skeptical as I have been, of people who insist they experience God, insist that prayer should look this way. However, and so here's where I think we need to think about this maybe more carefully. The same person who might rightly be skeptical of this approach to prayer, this showy, attention-grabbing approach to prayer, themselves are persisting in their own ways. So, I mean, what do you think it is to ask questions of God, to think about the degree to which you are in communion, you are communing with the one true God, to explore the relationship between God and joy, God and abundance, God and suffering, God and truth, between God and morality and God and justice and so on? It's interesting to me that we are perhaps rightly critical or skeptical of someone who experiences prayer in incredibly showy ways. And you could almost, you know, take a snapshot of that moment when you see that individual expressing themselves in prayer in this particular kind of way. And you could identify, and you could see in that moment that they are, in a sense, they're persisting. In a sense, they are expressing their human condition. They're opening it up before God. And again, I'm aware of the skeptic. I mean, we don't know the heart. Like, I'm offering a, you know, it's almost functioning as a thought experiment. Like, we're not talking about any particular actual person. We don't necessarily, of course, we can't know what's in the what is in the hearts of these individuals. But there's this idea that this kind of prayer, this kind of persistence, this kind of clamor, because it strikes us at a particular point in an emotional register, doesn't have certain validity. But then the very individual who might be critical of this approach to prayer, you know, gets in her car and is driving home and is unrelenting in the questions that she's asking about the nature of God, the goodness of God, you know, again, the justice of God, whatever it might be. And that individual is also relentless, relentlessly probing, relentlessly seeking. There's a desperation. If we were to compare these two types, there's a certain sense of desperation or need or persistence in them both, even though they could not be more different in their expression. So there's an important corrective here, at least for me, on the picture of prayer. Your critique, or my critique, of the disingenuous or even naive approach to prayer that I outlined in first may be less about an authentic critique of the ways in which people experience God, and more about some kind of implicit bias against the ways other traditions within Christian orthodoxy have arguably abused prayer. And in that way, this parable is provocative. It forces the question, what allows a prayer to be authentic? These examples that are so egregious to us, that have caused truly many people, I think, people to walk out of the doors of a church and to see it as a place where people are showboating or something. I'm not trying to make an argument that this is the best mechanism by which we approach God. I'm simply saying, how much within that human experience, how much of that person has to be sincere about what they're doing, has to think that something about what they're doing is effectual or true for it to constitute faith in prayer. 10%, 1%, does half of their heart and being have to mean some of what they're saying, however expressed, for it to be sincere? And of course, these questions don't have answers, and it's the wrong way of framing a question about prayer. But that's exactly the point. How human can we be? How flawed can we be? How many times have you been in the position where, you're asking a question about about the nature of God, about the justice of God? And if somebody were to really dig down, your desire for an answer is as egocentric and is as selfish and is as much about you as somebody who's praying for, a new car. It's interesting to me the extent to which our egos just suck up all of the air in the room as we're engaging in faith and prayer. And I think that something, as I've been meditating on these parables, and something that I keep going back to, there are certain signposts that are really helpful indicators that our experience of prayer is God honoring and is in the tradition of the faith. And one for me is grace. I think this is a signpost when you become honest with yourself, to go back to the Anne Lamott quote prior, when you become honest with yourself about what you can't control. We can't even control, it seems that it's difficult to control our own minds, our own egos, as we're trying to connect with God. When we see the extreme limits of our ability to control, and then when that depravity, the desperation begins to set in, and we see that even in prayer, our motives are often distorted, or if we really explore them, the drivers that we have that inform what we actually want, that our desires are this form of suffering. Quick head nod to the couple of people who might be hearing this that with whom I watched Stalker with most recently. But I think there's something, again, persistent about faith and prayer, that through all of that, all of the noise and mess, we experience grace. And we know that we are so loved. Again, What allows prayer to be authentic? What constitutes valid prayer? If your measure of successful prayer is how you feel before or after the prayer has taken place, then your psychological or emotional well-being becomes the metric by which we determine God's interest in us. In fact, the metric by which we know God loves us is Christ. In this way, the fervency of our prayer as some kind of metric for our closeness to Christ and the truthfulness, the validity of our faith is no better or worse than some kind of intellectual pursuit of Christ in prayer, where if this question can be answered, if this question or problem can be alleviated, then my faith will be established. It's actually more filled with grace. It's more beautiful than that. It is a God who objectively knows us, loves us, knows our needs, even when we do not perceive that this is the case at all. And how then do we understand and allow our faith to grow in spite of the frustrations of prayer? We turn again to Jesus, who models for us the fullness of Christ. And we meditate on that, and we, again, as an act of faith, see that the life of Jesus, the fullness of Christ, becomes our life too, becomes our fullness too. And I'm trying to avoid language that is, it's impossible to avoid the mystical here. Because when we're talking about God's closeness to us, and when we're talking about the imitation of Christ, we must rely on some feature of contemplative prayer and some form of mysticism. It's the fullness of Christ that we see in the scriptures, and then we begin to experience by turning our faith and our attention to this Christ, to this Jesus, that allows us to enjoy the fullness as well. And maybe if there's only one thing that you take away from our entire from this entire talk, it would be this. Sometimes, please hold on to this. Remember that sometimes God allows us to be privy to the ways he is conforming us to his likeness. And sometimes it is happening, but nearly invisible to us. And this leads me to my final and very brief observation, born out of the parable, which is point number four, which is that you should embrace, you really must embrace your experience of the divine. You must embrace your experience of the divine. It will always be more flawed than you would like. The prayer will always be more frustrating than you would like. It will always be more filled. You'll always actually be more aware of your ego than you would like. It brings out so much of what frustrates us about being human, but we should actually not run from, but embrace our experience. However it presents itself, we should embrace our experience of the divine, because even when we identify in that experience parts of ourselves that like the persistent widow, are unappealing or wrong or vengeful, even that is an opportunity to see the grace of God as something bigger and as something deeper than our shortcomings as human beings. Embrace your experience of the divine, and in doing so, you'll find that through grace, God will continue to refine you and continue to mold you into his likeness. I'm going to give something that's very, very practical, just as a conclusion, with no elaboration. I know that one of our center communities is currently reading through Keller's, I think, great survey of prayer. You know, it's in some ways it's a surface treatment, but it's so useful to just hear him think through the different approaches to prayer through Christian history and orthodoxy. And so this is directly from Keller in chapter 9 of his book. I'm not going to elaborate on any of these. I just want to highlight them for you. What is prayer? What is prayer? Keller frames that, I think, very clearly. And there's four things that he gives us. One, prayer is a discipline. Two, prayer is a conversation. Three, prayer is scriptural and spirit-led, or prayer is a scriptural and spirit-led meditation. Here we begin to see him kind of including the form of prayer I find most effective in my life, have found most effective, which is some kind of contemplative prayer. Prayer is scriptural, ascriptural, and spirit-led meditation. And number four, prayer is praise, confession, thanks, and petition. So, Center Church, if you have not taken prayer seriously in a very long time, and therefore, effectively, you no longer pray, start praying again. Those of you who have expanded prayer, you've abstracted it to such a degree that prayer is anything and therefore nothing, start praying again. This is a time for prayer, but all seasons are a time for prayer. E.M. Bounds says this, "Prayers are deathless. They outlive the lives of those who uttered them." Look, the reality is that as your love for other people expands and as you bring new people into your life, it's a strange kind of paradox that the more you love the person that you bring into your life, this could be a spouse, it could be a child, it could be a son or a daughter, it could be like a relationship you've established with somebody, a close, deep friendship. There's this very interesting thing that, like, the more they mean to you, the more you see how much they need you. The more your anxiety, the more your worry increases, because what would they do? What would they do without you? And at first pass, that might sound somewhat self-serving, but it actually really isn't. The church is organized so that, like, there is this deep and abiding love for one another. And if you don't find a way to resolve that, every great love actually is just a source of tremendous anxiety and worry, and then sometimes depression and stress and all of it. And some of you know exactly what I mean by this. It's your spouse, it's your son or your daughter, it's your mom or your dad. And actually, the scriptures offer clarity on this. Bounds is right. Prayers are deathless. Hebrews 11 is correct. One of the most brilliant chapters on faith, and I think also prayer, all at once. This is Hebrews 11, verse 39. "And all of them, though reputed for their faithfulness, did not obtain the thing promised." In other words, they were martyred. They died before they received the fullness of God's kingdom. "God, having foreseen something better with regard to us, so that they should not be made complete without us." Your relationship with those who are part of the body, this bond, this relationship, this caretaking, absolutely transcends death. It breezes right by it. Do you want to keep taking care of your spouse long after you're gone? Pray for them now, because prayers are deathless. Do you want to know that actually it's the case that whether your son or daughter knows you well into adulthood, rest easy. Take heart. Have peace, because prayers are deathless. You will be loving and guiding and supporting the body long after you're gone, because the prayers continue, and they once spoken, they're never unspoken. Well, we've talked about a lot today. I hope it's useful for you as you engage in conversation around prayer, and I look forward to talking with you next week.